Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. This hour of the program, Josh Krushauer is joining us. He wrote an interesting piece that we are going to be talking about that appeared in the National Journal, where he is the managing editor for politics. Playbook for a Democratic comeback. The key to the party's revival lies in the upscale suburbs where Hillary Clinton made strong inroads. Josh is the political editor, as I said, for National Journal. He pens the weekly Against the Grain column. He has had several positions since joining Atlantic Media in 2010. Prior to working there, he was a political correspondent for Politico, has appeared as a political analyst on TV and radio, including Fox, MSNBC, CNN, National Public Radio, and also C-SPAN. And he's here to talk about how the Democrats can win again and what kind of self-examination they need to do and where is their path to a coalition that will serve them well in the future. A little bit later during the course of this hour, today is KP Whaley's last day. He's been our steadfast, creative, wonderful producer with Scotty Myers for almost 4 years now. He's going off to North Carolina. So I thought we'd invite him in, and Scotty as well, if you have questions about, you know, this show is what makes the show is the production of the show and what they go through to find wonderful guests and have done so each and every day for year after year after year. They're just terrific. We have a very small staff, and they work hard, and I appreciate them so much. So it's kind of a sad day, too, to have KP go, but we thought we'd have both of them on so they can talk about putting this show together, and so you can wish KP well in his future endeavors. At any rate, our phone number, as you answer the question as well, what is the playbook for a Democratic comeback? 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. And Josh, hello. Thanks very much for being with us again.
Good to be back on the show.
Yeah, nice to have you here. Let's talk about this increasingly liberal base, which you say if they continue to dictate policy, the math for the Democrats gets a lot tougher, and the coming months will determine whether they'll be acting more like Walter Mondale or Bill Clinton in the wake of demoralizing defeats. I assume you would say to win, they need to pick Bill Clinton.
Well, look, the math of people's ideology has been remarkably consistent in the country, and Gallup actually just came out with its poll asking people whether they're liberal, moderate, or conservative. And even though the number of liberals has grown over the past decade, still just 25% of the country is liberal, while over 35% is conservative, and the rest are moderate, about a little over a third of the country. So if Democrats just rely on a liberal base, it's not close to a majority of the country. They can't win over a lot of voters who may generally vote Democratic, but tend to be on the more moderate side of the spectrum. And like I wrote in the column today, the most fascinating cross current in the election results is that you had a lot of voters who tend to vote Republican in the suburban parts of the country, the Atlanta suburbs, the Philadelphia suburbs, the Denver suburbs, across the board throughout the country, that actually voted for Hillary Clinton. They swung their votes overwhelmingly for Hillary Clinton in this presidential election, even though a lot of working-class white voters in states like Wisconsin and the Rust Belt and other parts of the country moved their, and some of them were Democrats, working-class Democrats, moved towards the Republican Party and voted for Donald Trump. But it underscores how if Democrats are looking to rebuild and actually win elections going forward, they're not only going to have to get good candidates and remodel their get out the vote efforts, but they're going to need to win over moderate Democrats, people who are maybe skeptical about the role of government, supporters of Israel, supporters of a more aggressive and activist foreign policy, people who were really alienated by Obama's second term, that thought Hillary Clinton had a lot of personal baggage, but tend to be fiscally conservative and more socially in line with the liberal values of the Democratic Party. And the fact that you had some of the most rock-ribbed Republican parts of the country, these business-friendly areas across the country that swung towards Hillary Clinton, a very polarizing figure of her own, for a very polarizing Democrat, shows that there is a base where Democrats can latch onto to get get majorities in the future, but they have to moderate their agenda. They have to sound more pragmatic on issues like trade, on issues like foreign policy, on issues like race relations.
Mm. Let's factor in, though, Donald Trump. Do you think that it's just an anomaly because Trump was the nominee that made many Republicans go to Hillary Clinton, that they thought that he was too outrageous for them in many ways, particularly in those fairly wealthy suburban areas that you're talking about? They couldn't stomach him as a person.
That's absolutely right, and that absolutely was a major factor in the election results. But Trump is now president, and he's going to be resetting the Republican Party towards his agenda. So that gives Democrats an opportunity. If for every action, there's a reaction. And if Democrats don't react appropriately and in a politically savvy fashion to what Trump is going to be doing to the Republican Party and how he's going to govern the country, they'll be missing a major opportunity. You know, for example, if he decides to kind of use his Twitter bully pulpit to condemn and criticize specific companies that export jobs overseas or that support policy, you know, support certain free market policies that they've done with the support of other Republican presidents. But with Trump's new populist tone, it gives Democrats an opportunity to actually talk about free trade, to talk about the benefits of lower costs, lower prices, the benefits of these trade agreements that, frankly, a lot of Republicans and Democrats supported, even though you do have intense opposition in both parties on the subject. But it gives Democrats an opportunity to go, I mean, in these very center-right, affluent communities, they're very much pro-trade. They're very much, you know, favorable towards business. And it's a way that they can really lock in, the Democrats can lock in the gains that they showed in 2016. Because Trump isn't going away, and his messaging is going to turn into policy, which could draw a blowback from some of these voters.
Mm-hmm. What is, you write in today's article, people ignoring the cultural disconnect between working class whites and the leadership of today's Democratic Party. What is the cultural disconnect, and is that an important one, or were the economic woes the issue and really nothing else mattered?
So I'm of the view that culture mattered more in the election than the actual economics, the lack of
really?
And growth. And sometimes they're tied together. So like on an issue like immigration, it's both a cultural issue. You know, people are kind of anxious about new people coming into their town or community. But it's also an economic one where there's a competition over jobs and people view new people that are getting lower proper salaries that are competing for the same types of jobs. So there's a lot of overlap. But, you know, I think like – Take the issue of transgender bathrooms, which was a big Democratic priority in the final year of Obama's administration. You know, whatever people think about the merits of that policy, I think a lot of voters in the Rust Belt, a lot of these working class communities, were wondering why this was such a big deal when they're losing their job, when they're having trouble making ends meet. So even though it's both an economic and a cultural issue. It's whether they agreed or disagreed with the rightness of what North Carolina was doing. What certain communities were doing, I think they wondered why there was so much emphasis put on such a niche issue when there are a lot of bigger fish to fry. So the notion of, I mean, I think a lot of these voters in Wisconsin and Minnesota and throughout the Midwest, a lot of these working class voters that went from Democrats to Trump in this election, it's not going to be as simple to win them back just by saying, I'm going to out-populist Donald Trump or I'm going to try to match him in terms of his populist rhetoric. I think there's some cultural components to why the party left the Democrats and moved to the Republican Party. And I don't think it's going to be as easy as just sounding like Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren. I don't think that's the path to winning these voters.
Do you think in some parts of the country, you talk about the northern part of the country, that the white working class group that went to Donald Trump is lost to the Democrats forevermore, at least the foreseeable future?
So that's the big question. That's we've seen in the last, there were two different waves of previously solid Democratic voters throughout the country. First in the South in the mid-1990s when Clinton became president, and a little bit later in the Appalachian region of the country, western Pennsylvania, Kentucky, Tennessee, and some of these other states around there, where working class white voters went from being reliably Democratic to being rock-solid Republicans. And in the South, it happened mostly in the mid-90s. In Appalachia, it happened really in Obama's first election. And the big question is this phenomenon happening in the North, in Wisconsin, in Minnesota, in a lot of the Midwestern states where Trump made such sizable gains? Now, there's a compelling argument that Trump was uniquely compelling to these voters, that if he's in office and doesn't live up to his promises, they have a northern working-class white voters could end up going back into the Democratic fold, or at least more in the Democratic fold than they did in 2016. But there's also a compelling case that the Democratic Party is so reliant on sort of a cultural liberalism that is really out of step with the communities in these working class areas, that it's going to be really hard to reverse the nature of where the party is headed. And you know, the Democratic Party isn't the party that it was when it elected FDR with its New Deal coalition, or LBJ with all the government programs that benefited some of these working class communities. It's, you look at identity politics being such a driving force in the Democratic Party these days, and it's hard to see how they're going to compromise a whole lot on that front. And if that doesn't change, if that end of the party doesn't change, or that dynamic doesn't change, I think it's going to be challenging for Democrats to really do a whole lot better than they did in 2016. Hmm. Maybe they can do a little bit better, but I don't think the days of working class union voters voting Democratic, I think, are long over.
Mm-hmm. What about the progressive wing, the Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren wing of the Democratic Party? Are there issues that they are campaign? Well, certainly Bernie Sanders did very well, you have to admit, in the whole campaign. He won a lot of states. So obviously there's a message there that's resonating among some Democrats. How do you hold that group of Democrats for future elections? And aren't there indeed some issues that he's been espousing and other progressives have been espousing that may have, you know, widespread interest?
So there certainly were some issues that he tapped into that really energized the left wing of the Democratic Party and allowed him to do quite well in the Democratic nominating process. I would caution two things, though, when you look at his results and numbers in the primary that were unusual for a challenger. Number one, Hillary Clinton barely attacked him. She didn't think he was capable of winning the nomination. So usually in a campaign, you have a lot of attack ads back and forth. But Hillary Clinton largely held her fire, at least on the airwaves. And Sanders had these great favorability ratings because no one really laid a glove on him. Republicans wanted Sanders to be the nominee. They thought he was going to be actually a weaker candidate than Clinton, so they didn't attack him. And Clinton thought she didn't want to alienate the liberal, outspoken wing of her party, so she largely stayed clear of him and just kind of took a stay-the-course approach to the nomination, which ended up allowing her to win the nomination but losing the general election. There is a legitimate case to be made that you can focus on issues like trade and issues like income inequality that working class voters might be very receptive to. The question is, can these candidates, can the progressive Democrats out Trump on those very issues? So it seems like Trump has already monopolized that space. And even before he takes office as president, when he announces he's saving jobs from a Carrier air conditioning plant in Indiana from going abroad, when he's talking about, you know, protecting Ford jobs from going overseas to Mexico, that creates a pretty tight bond between these working class voters and Donald Trump, and they already supported him in pretty strong numbers this election. So the question is, can you really make sizable inroads with a constituency that was trending away from the party, or does it make more sense to reorient the party in a more market, business friendly, moderate direction, which again, based on the results, there's some real opportunity for Democrats on that front.
Don't you, in a sense, Josh, have to wait a little while to see how Trump is going to govern? Certainly the Republicans want to repeal Obamacare, and they are very much at that today. The president-elect has also talked about that being a huge goal of his. If, as some are worried about, there is a repeal but not an adequate replacement, and you have millions of people in America losing their health insurance, and many of them are the very people, working-class people, who probably did vote for Donald Trump. There's so many what-ifs here with policy that you might be able to save some carrier jobs, but what if you lose your health insurance? So we don't know. Things are in such flux, we don't know where he's going.
That's a terrific point, and that's pretty much where a lot of Democrats are right now, in that they think that Trump is going to be such a disaster or have a lot of issues in governing that he's going to be so unpopular that it doesn't matter what Democrats do. They'll automatically, in fact, Obama, according to several news reports today, advised House and Senate Democrats basically to act like the Tea Party, to oppose everything Trump and congressional Republicans do, because inevitably they're going to overreach or that their policies aren't going to be popular and Democrats are going to take control of power by default. I think that's possible given how polarizing Trump is, but I think that's a very foolhardy way to really set you know, to set the new year and the new presidency. Because if you're wrong, it's a very dangerous gamble to make if you're wrong. And Democrats have underestimated Donald Trump. I mean, a lot of Republicans did, too.
Yes, everybody did,
campaign.
Absolutely.
Right. And if the problem is, if you're wrong, even a little bit wrong, and if Trump actually is able to, you know, do these PR promotions where he says he's saving jobs in the Midwest and helping create jobs in key sectors, and if the economy gets a little bit better, and if he's actually able to, you know, claim some credit for economic growth, the whole notion of just being oppositional, it will backfire. And I think Democrats don't realize how polarizing and unpopular passing the health care law was in the first place. If it was popular, if it grew popular over time, Democrats wouldn't be in the predicament that they're in. But the challenge with Obamacare and some of the other legislation that Obama was very aggressive in passing through a Democratic Congress in his first couple years was that it didn't turn out to be popular. So he's been kind of holding that on the heads of other Democrats for quite some time. And Republicans now have a separate challenge, which is how to reverse the law without creating another group of discontented constituents or discontented voters. But I think basically the premise of Democrats just saying let Trump overreach, let him cause his own problems, right, assumes that he's going to be a disaster. And I think it's very likely he could actually end up being a lot more successful than some Democratic skeptics believe.
Josh Krasauer is our guest, and we're talking about a playbook for a Democratic comeback. Would you agree the key of the party's revival lies in the upscale suburbs where Hillary Clinton made strong inroads, or is the key to comeback somewhere else? If so, where would that be? Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter, @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network. This hour, Democratic Party and how it refashions itself for a comeback. Josh Krasauer is our guest, political editor for the National Journal. He pains the weekly Against the Grain column. And we have tons of phone calls coming in, a lot of interest in this, so let's go to George first in Milwaukee. Hello, George.
Yes, hi. I disagree with your guest regarding the way the Democratic Party should go. I think it should go in a more populist, progressive direction. I think that his analysis is faulty in this respect. When you look at who voted for Obama as opposed to who didn't vote for Hillary and who ended up voting for Trump, you've got something like 18% more white men with no college degree voted for Obama, 8% more of white women with no college degree voted for Obama. And these are people, I should say, the 18% and 8% are those people who had voted for Obama and now had voted for Trump. And a whole lot of people under $50,000 voted for Trump rather than Hillary. I think it's really because it wasn't because of that they saw Hillary as being a lot more culturally liberal than Obama. I think it's because she failed to make the case to the working class that she would really work in their interests.
Josh, what do you think?
Well, look, I mean, there's an argument that can be made that Hillary was the outlier, that instead of being a trend away from the Democrats, from Obama to Trump, and as the guest pointed out, as the caller pointed out, there were a lot of Obama-Trump voters, that it was a blip rather than a trend. But to me, you know, Obama's second term was filled with, I mean, he was very politically savvy in his first term and didn't do things outside of the health care law that were designed to really rile up the working class voters. And in fact, Obamacare was intended to win over those working class voters. It didn't work out that way. The law is deeply unpopular with that constituency. But when he was able to not be on a ballot again and didn't have to worry about his own political consequences, he really unleashed a lot of executive orders, you know, whether it was the executive order on immigration, on legalizing certain illegal children of illegal immigrants, whether it was you know, the issue of transgender bathrooms, whether it was a lot of the social issues came to the forefront, and terrorism was also a major issue, and that not technically a social issue, but national security with the rise of ISIS and the concern about the national security challenges under Obama's watch, those became big problems for Democrats. And I don't think that's all on Hillary Clinton's shoulders. I think that this current president has a lot of ownership in those problems. So, you know, look, there's a lot different voters have different reasons for why they voted the way they did. But I think expecting the Democratic Party to do what Obama did in 2012 and do what he did in 2008, I don't think even Obama could come close to matching his 2012 performance with those working class voters. I think the party has moved too far, and Obama himself in his second term has moved very far away from where he was in the first term and where Democrats have traditionally been.
How do you factor in, Josh, the fact that huge numbers of people didn't like either of these candidates, and they really didn't like these candidates? That's a pretty unusual thing to have happen in an American presidential race, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, maybe in today's nonstop social media attack culture, maybe it won't be that unusual in the future. But yeah, I mean, if anyone other, I mean, the saying went during the election, if any other Republican other than Trump was the nominee, they probably would have won in a runaway. And if any other Democrat other than Clinton, if Joe Biden was the nominee, maybe even Sanders, who knows? But another Democrat other than Hillary Clinton was the nominee, it's a good chance they would have defeated Donald Trump. So you had two very unlikable candidates, and it was. The campaign was run in this nonstop social media culture where every little mistake was scrutinized and debated on cable news. So, yeah, I mean, these were two awful candidates. It was even people who vote. I think one of the big flaws in the analysis running up to the election is there were a lot of voters who said that they viewed Trump as a misogynist, a sexist, having racially insensitive views, but they still, a decent number, still voted for him regardless. He actually won women. He won a majority of women voters in the country. So that, even though they disliked him, they still voted for him, and I think people thought it would have happened the other way around.
Thanks, George, so much for your call. Pete and Nina, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my guest, Kathleen, and also, you know, I wanted to agree with the previous caller, George, that to suggest that the party needs to become more moderate is pretty ridiculous after what we just went through in terms of this election. You know, working class voters abandoned the party because basically the Democratic Party abandoned the working class. It's not that difficult to win them back. Bernie Sanders showed we could do it, and he did it. And, you know, basically Hillary Clinton ran as the ultimate moderate. So it's pretty ridiculous to me to suggest that we need to become more moderate, more Clinton-esque. You know, that's ridiculous. She ran as a technocrat that could more effectively manage the system when, you know, everyone pretty much wanted to burn down the system. They're fed up with inequality and elite power and corruption, and Hillary Clinton essentially represented more of the same. She was establishment, a.k.a. moderate, and that's not what the voters wanted. I mean, basically any other candidate other than Hillary Clinton could have beaten Donald Trump. But, you know, she was the only candidate. The Democratic Party cleared the field for her, and she was the only candidate that could not speak credibly on the issue of the economy and economic inequality. You know, her husband pushed through NAFTA. She was a supporter of TPP. And just her general affiliation with the banks meant that she could never actually speak credibly on the issue of inequality.
Interesting point, Josh.
Well, I think that those are relevant points, but I also think it's important to note that, going back to what we were talking about at the top of the show, that she actually made remarkable gains in the suburban parts of the country, even as Trump made gains in the working class parts of the country. But the suburban areas are the growing parts of the country, and the working class towns are declining in population. So if you're looking for a good long-term strategy for Democrats, the Clinton strategy, frankly, was the right one. In fact, she won the popular vote by 2 points as well. She was a weak candidate. She was not a good politician. She has the baggage of running on her legacy, on her family name. But the message and the ideology undergirding the party is important. And I think if you had a more compelling candidate, think about Cory Booker, or maybe, you know, Amy Klobuchar in Minnesota, or Claire McCaskill in Missouri, and you have a centrist message, one that is designed to play to these suburban voters, the growing families in these suburban communities, where Clinton did make gains despite all of her baggage. That's more of a future-oriented message. It's one that's likely to win the Democratic Party more votes. And I also look back, you know, if you look back at Obama's tenure in office, and you look, you know, a lot of people are trying to pin 2016 on Hillary Clinton alone, but Obama managed to lose the House in 2010. He lost the Senate in 2014, and he lost the presidency in 2016. Three of the four elections when he was president resulted in landslide losses for his party, and two of the three were not when Hillary Clinton was on the ballot. So to simply say this was a Clinton problem, she was too moderate, she clearly had her problems, but I think it's a problem that's deep-rooted in the Democratic Party, and it really points to a need for reform and moderation going forward.
And yet his approval ratings are pretty darn high, aren't they?
His approval ratings are high, though he wasn't running a campaign. I mean, it helps when you're kind of staying above the fray in the middle of a very nasty campaign. And, in fact, the Politico commissioned a poll. I know President Obama is saying if he ran against Trump himself, he would have won. It was actually interesting that the poll came out today, sort of a fantasy politics poll that actually showed Trump beating Obama by 1 point.
Really?
So I think Obama was sort of trying to, again, blame Clinton. A lot of Democrats in the White House are trying to throw Clinton under the bus after this obviously very disappointing election for them. But I think there are a lot of failure has a lot of people to blame. And I think that Obama's leadership and some of his positioning on issues really were as responsible as Clinton's own weak campaign.
Pete, thanks so much for your call. Jeff in Madison, hi.
Yes, I don't think one can underestimate the impact of Hillary being viewed as a flawed candidate. And why? Because a lot of people did not believe who she said she was. In the same way, I don't think one can overestimate Trump's win. He won 19.6% of the U.S. population. He won less than a third of registered voters, 31%. So she lost, I believe, because people saw her as flawed. Come 2020, when the population discovers Trump is not who he said he is, I don't think it would be too outrageous to expect a major turn, and I think to start calling for the Democratic Party to make wholesale policy changes because of this vote could be a big mistake. I'm interested in what your guest has to say. I'll listen off air.
Thanks, Jeff.
So it goes back to, do you basically bet on Trump self-immolating, that he's going to be so unpopular in office that you don't have to do anything? You can just watch him dig himself into his own problems. And that's what Democrats seem to be doing right now. And maybe that would work. I'm not ruling out that possibility. But like I said earlier, the risk of doing that is that you allow Republicans to set the agenda and you put yourself well behind the eight ball if Trump actually is a little bit more popular than you might have expected. So Trump has benefited from the bigotry of low expectations throughout this campaign. And I think that would just be gifting him and underestimating his appeal to some of these working class voters and his ability. Look, I mean, and also, if you totally write off these sort of Republican-leaning or independent voters that have voted Republican, and you don't think that they're worth being part of your future coalition, then you're giving Trump a chance to win these voters over. If Trump has locked down a lot of these working-class voters and he governs in a more effective way that actually wins some of these skeptics in Republican areas, in Dallas, Houston, Atlanta, Philadelphia, people that voted Republican couldn't stand Trump, but maybe they'll see him in office and might have a slightly more positive view, then you're really in a deep hole. Then you're really starting from scratch and having trouble forging together a majority. So, you know, look, you can totally bet on Trump failing, and I understand why that's a popular view. But if he doesn't, Democrats could really be in a big hole if they don't prepare accordingly. Mm.
Here's a comment from Hans. We're going to zero in on the Midwest now, which is worth doing. My question for your guest pertains to the voting trends in the Rust Belt and the upper Midwest. The difference between Trump and Clinton in states like Wisconsin was 20,000 votes. When you look at the primaries, you could see the writing on the wall for Clinton's loss. Sanders dominated Clinton in the Wisconsin primary, while Trump lost to Ted Cruz. The results in states like Wisconsin was more a rejection of Clinton, the candidate, and establishment politics than a swing to the Republican Party. How do you, Josh, explain the results of the general election in light of the primaries in the Midwest?
Well, I agree that there was a rejection of establishment politics. That I definitely agree with. And Clinton's image of being the wife of a former president and sort of having an entitled mean about her was very damaging, and certainly in those Midwestern states. That said, look, the margins, like the emailer mentioned were so slim, you could see, you know, if some of those voters coming back if Trump doesn't live up to his promises. You just need a handful of votes to move in the Democratic direction without doing anything, frankly, to win back Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, or even just one of those states. And when you go to the more kind of upscale coalition, the more you're targeting the more affluent, business-friendly voters in states like Virginia, North Carolina, Florida, and Colorado, not only do you have more electoral votes in those states, but those are the voters who, you know, are more important to the future of the party. So if you think that you can get a little bit of those voters in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, the margins are so slim there that you can, you know, just get a little bit of that back and then focus on these voters that actually moved to the Democratic Party in the last election because they were so dissatisfied with Trump, that suggests you could actually build a longer-lasting coalition. The Democrats won those Midwestern states by such large margins before 2016, or enough of a margin before 2016, that they have a little more wiggle room, that they could lose. You know, this upscale vote strategy acknowledges that you're probably going to lose some working-class voters in those states. But you could also win some back that didn't go for Democrats because of Clinton's unique challenges. And you can think about the long-term gains that the party really needs in those southern and Sun Belt states.
Claire in Madison. Hello, Claire.
Hi, Kathleen. I'm so sorry you're losing your wonderful KP.
I know. I am too.
I'm sorry, but I, too, am calling to respectfully disagree with your guest. I think the Democratic Party, and I hope any party leaders that are listening, please listen to Bernie Sanders' message because it resounded with people. Wisconsin went 70 of 72 counties for Bernie in the primary. Bernie was accessible to people. And I think Donald Trump saw that and started to kind of steal some of Bernie's ways of rallying and stuff. On the other hand, Hillary came across as a total elitist. I believe in the state of Wisconsin there was only one free rally for Hillary Clinton. All the rest you had to pay to go to. And after the primary, of course, she didn't come back to Wisconsin a single time. That is elitist. That was a big, big mistake. And that's what the Dems need to learn. We need to be accessible and upfront. And the up-and-coming demographic for voters is younger and more liberal, not more conservative.
Josh.
Well, there are a couple challenges. A, younger voters don't vote as reliably, period, whether it's even in the presidential election where the turnout levels were underwhelming, and certainly not in midterm elections where turnout drops off among young voters pretty significantly. So they may be the future, but a lot of times younger voters get more moderate as they grow up and have families, and you can't just automatically assume in 10, 20 years these young voters are going to, you know, foreshadow a permanent liberal majority. And again, only 25% of the country self-describes themselves as liberal right now. It's up a little bit from the last decade, but it's not foreshadowing this huge shift in our country's politics. We're still a pretty centrist country, and if you're too far to the liberal base, you might energize voters like some of the callers today, but it's not a way to win the kind of the silent majority of the people in the middle that vote but are kind of turned off by the extreme rhetoric.
Mm. Yeah, we're getting a lot of Bernie voters today. It's amazing. And I think
he did win in Wisconsin. I mean,
he did.
And Wisconsin is a state that Trump is really captured a certain formula that even though he actually did worse than Mitt Romney in the Milwaukee suburbs, he was able to really, really raise his game in the western part of the state, the working class precincts in the state, and actually won it for the first time since 1984 for Republicans.
Let's go to Madeline and De Pere. Hi, Madeline.
Hi. I'm another Bernie supporter. Uh-huh. And, you know, not only the Democratic Party, but the entire news media, including people in public radio and public TV, they were so clearly on Hillary's side. And I predict that the Republican Party is going to screw itself up because I think they'll remove health care. They're going to just remove so many benefits for the people, perhaps even cut back on Medicare, Social Security, all that. I think the next round is going to be different. But if we're dumb and we go for another moderate we may be in trouble again.
Mm. What sacred cows do the Republicans need to keep their hands off, or they're going to be in trouble down the road, Josh?
Well, look, this Obamacare repeal and replace debate is going to be a fascinating test about how malleable the working class voters, maybe some of these Bernie supporters as well, view Trump. Because it's fascinating. The polling, even though Obamacare is a very polarizing issue, and even though working class white voters disproportionately benefit from the benefits in Obamacare, they're among the most anti-Obamacare constituency out there. So it's going to be fascinating. If some of the benefits are taken away or temporarily rolled back or whatever happens, will they blame Trump? Will they blame Republicans? Will they move back to the Democratic Party? Or, like we've been talking about earlier in the show, is it the cultural issues? Is it, you know, the Democratic Party's shift left on a lot of social
right.
issues that's really driven them away? And will they stay with Trump? And will they largely become de facto Republicans? I think it's an unanswered question. It's crucial to where the party is in a few years. But a lot of pundits, a lot of economic specialists thought that Obamacare was a win-win situation because even the people that were against it at the time would get these benefits and they'd support it. And it turned out that never happened. And when the base of support came from a lot of the people who benefited them on paper the most. So I think it's very unpredictable how this is going to all.
Yeah, I think you're right. One more call. Ruth in Milton. Hi.
Oh, yes. I'm in my mid-70s, have a lot of friends all over, having come from a family, military, medical corps family, Peace Corps family, three members. So all of my circle of friends supported Hillary Clinton, and I am so tired of every program on the station of hearing how unpopular she was. It just became such a myth. Well, for one thing, she certainly has served children and women. She served her country. Now,
but she lost the election, Ruth.
Yes, and Donald Trump and his family, what have they ever done for our country? And I am afraid that you're going to keep saying that these voters who voted for him, they are not mean-spirited white supremacists, but they need to explore their delusion.
Thank you very much for your call. And obviously there were a number of enthusiastic supporters, but it came as a shock to everybody that she lost the election. So the point of the discussion is what the Democrats need to do to not lose the next presidential election. Josh, thank you very much for being with us. Always a pleasure to speak with you. And the audience loved it, too. You got a lot of calls, Josh.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. Josh Krushauer, our guest, political editor for the National Journal. He pens the Weekly Against the Grain column, and we'll have that column on our Facebook page, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Today's K.P. Whaley's last day as extraordinary producer of this program, and he's done a lot of work for Wisconsin Public Radio as well. And I wanted to take the last few minutes of the program to wish him well, to invite you to wish him well as well. And also we invited Scotty and Myers to be here, too. I hope that they know how much I appreciate what they do to bring you really meaningful radio day after day. I think you have no idea when a guest cancels at 11 o'clock the night before and what the heck are you going to do? You got little time to do this, but they're very thoughtful, hardworking producers. I've been in this business 40 years, and I've never had a group of people as wonderful as this working on the program that I'm involved in. But it would be nowhere near the program it is without both of these people. And so I wanted to talk to KP about why he chose public radio and where he's going and what shows he's particularly fond of. And maybe he'll tell a joke. He told a joke that you couldn't see just by his facial expression. But I wanted to thank him publicly. And okay, KP, don't you want to reconsider?
Well, it was a very tough decision, as you know. I have been a fan of Kathleen's show long before I was a producer, and a fan as long as I have been a producer. So thank you for doing the great work that you do here, and you're the reason I'm a producer here in the first place. So I really do appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. And what is it about public radio? Why, you've had a lot of careers in your lifetime. He's reinvented himself, audience, many times, and I think he's who he is now, his true self, is doing this kind of work, even though you do it at some sacrifice. But what is it about the mission of what we do and what you will do as well, I think, in some regards when you go to Asheville, North Carolina?
Yeah, I think public media is something that I got involved with about a little more than 10 years ago, 11, 12 years ago. And mostly it was I had been working in corporate America. I kind of felt I had reached my limit there, and in some ways I kind of felt a part of a problem that was happening with the American society, and so I wanted to be on the other side of it for a little while. So I started out working in community radio. I do actually have a degree in broadcasting as well, but I never used it until 10 years ago. And so it's what attracts me is that you're giving voice to communities that aren't typically represented in mainstream media. You're covering issues that are from all perspectives, so you can actually help people become educated on issues and come to their own conclusions and come to their own decisions on what they need to do with that information. Mm-hmm. So I think that is what attracts me. I, you know, in some ways have a lot of issues that I am very passionate about and want to bring attention to, and certainly this show and public radio in general allows me to do that. And then when it comes to hard political issues, I think having worked on this show over the past nearly 4 years, having that ability to see all sides of an issue helps inform in many ways that you know, other outlets don't allow for.
Yeah, and I think that you really have the ability, more than most of us, to be able to see all of those sides of an issue, and I really appreciate your and our understanding of them and give them all credence, and it's a very important quality. And you do that with human beings, too, which is also very important. I must tell, this is kind of an inside story, I hope you don't mind, but I wrote this to KP yesterday. Maybe I shouldn't say this story, but when he was being interviewed for the show, I said, you know, there are certain things that find their way on the air perhaps more than many of you would like. And one of them is
the
dogs.
Behind the scenes of Kathleen Dunn Show could be scary.
We tried to bring a dog into this studio as much as possible, and KP lost beautiful Lucky, his dog, who used to rescue the dog in Puerto Rico. For heaven's sake, how could you not hire him? I mean, seriously, it was just, you know, dogs at first sight. That's what happened. And then Lucky came to the station with you, and my other one is, you know, Abraham Lincoln. But I think the three of us, and Scotty is here as well, that we come into work and we're just right into a discussion of what's going on, right? We're on top of the news. It's just like having the best of family to talk about these issues at the dinner table and the breakfast table, and I appreciate that so much. Plus, you both have such great senses of humor that it's a real delight.
Yeah, we sure are going to miss KP. And I would say we just talked about the three of us, but there's sort of a fourth dimension here, and that is our listeners. I mean, every morning we come to the office, and yes, us three are chatting and having this really vigorous conversation about political news and all kinds of fun stories circulating in newspapers and throughout the headlines. But our listeners are present in those moments too, whether we're talking about a Facebook comment or a show idea that was pitched to us or a caller that we heard from the day before. Right before I walked into the studio today, Lisa Nalbandian, our regional manager, was answering phone calls, and she was receiving phone calls from listeners saying, you know, please pass along my thanks and gratitude to KP Whaley. And that's the relationship that we have with our listeners, and that shouldn't be underestimated or underappreciated. So that's That's a huge part of what
Absolutely.
Makes this work.
And yeah. they're a big part of this show, too. I yeah. love having listeners call into our show. We want to open phone lines, speaking of listeners, so you can call and ask KP and Scotty any questions you have about how this show is put together. But also, please call and wish KP well as he heads off to Asheville, North Carolina. And we'll miss him so, and it's always good to have good wishes and appreciation for all the work that he's done, for heaven's sake. It's a Amen. Lot.
Hear, hear.
Yeah, 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. Scott in La Crosse calls. Hi, Scott.
Hi there. I'm a first-time caller. Oh, you know, you guys, all three of you, do such a wonderful job. I cannot tell you how much I appreciate it. It's just, it's an absolute and total pleasure to listen in. And I'm going to miss you, KP. You can do some craft brewing out there?
I definitely am.
All right.
Yeah, Asheville is kind of known as like the beer capital of the United States.
Is that right?
Yeah, a lot
as
of
you
sit
in Milwaukee, Wisconsin?
It's craft brewing.
Yeah, break the news to Portlandia for me, would you? Anyhow, I do wish you all the best.
Thank
and,
you.
You know, you've done just such a wonderful job, and all you guys just keep up what you do, because we, the listeners, I'm going to go out on the limb here and speak for everybody. We really appreciate the heck out of it. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you, Scott. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you. It's nice to hear. Cindy in Fox Cities. Hi, Cindy.
Hello. Well, first of all, I want to say, KP, I met you personally when I was at the Elm Grove Women's Club with the Kathleen Dunn
right.
program.
Yeah.
You did a solar year or two ago, and I just want to tell everybody what a nice man you are, and you sound just like you look. So.
That's,
you do.
I don't think
so. And I
want to
wish you good luck and say thank you for all you've done. And Scotty, you're not able to leave now.
Yeah, right.
No,
exactly.
Scotty's
I
not
agree.
Going. No. I mean, if he
so
has to,
wishes.
He does. But yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank yep. you, Cindy. Thanks for the call. Leslie in Wisconsin. Hi, Leslie.
Hey, I'm one of the callers who usually calls in with an opposite point of view, and sometimes I can be just smoking mad and just ready to rip somebody. And these guys are so professional and so thoughtful and just really, really, I really feel like they are really genuinely trying to see my point of view, but I know it's not their point of view, but they never have talked down or anything. They're just always very professional and super. They sound like great guys.
Thanks, Leslie. I do know the voice. Thank you so much. I
Thank
appreciate
you.
That.
Yep.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Leslie, very much. Ron in Boscobel. Hi, Ron.
Hi there. I just wanted to ask KP what made him choose to go to Asheville in the middle of Cherokee country and what he's going to be doing there.
I actually lived in Asheville, actually a little outside of Asheville, Hendersonville, a few years ago, and was managing a small community radio station there. And funding kind of threw that all into chaos, and volunteers went on and created their own little FM station that they ran on the internet until they were able to achieve licensing. And they've been on the air for a few years now and are in a position of needing a GM. So I'm moving on to lead a group of very dedicated and passionate volunteers who do great music and political and news shows and are looking for some help.
And let me just chime in to say that our loss is definitely Asheville's gain. KP is perfectly suited. And you know how this is. Sometimes you walk into a new job and you have sort of doubts about your capabilities, and we all have that in a new position. And when I heard KP sort of whisper those to me, I'm like, are you serious? You're going to hit this out of the park. Your personality, your intelligence, your kindness, your ability to mediate and arbitrate and to just facilitate these kinds of conversations, there's no doubts here.
Yeah.
And you'll be happy doing it.
I will. And Asheville is just a beautiful, if you've not been to Western North Carolina, it's not anything like the eastern part of the state, where it's flat and hot and dry all the time. So Western North Carolina is a beautiful place in the country. And, you know, you can grow food until December, and you can run into the mountains and get cool during the summer and jump into a river somewhere off a rock. So it's really a pretty astounding place.
And you can have as many dogs as you want.
And I can have lots of dogs and chickens and bees.
And today
bees
you say you might
animals.
Have a pig. That'd be great. I want pictures of your pig. You'll see and tell. You'll send us pictures, won't you?
Of course.
Okay, please do. Cheryl in Conover. Hi, Cheryl.
Well, just look at it this way, KP. You'll never be sub-zero weather in Asheville, North Carolina.
I've been looking at that all week long, Cheryl.
My best friend of 40-some years lives in Charlotte, and she keeps telling me, get out of there, because we go back and forth to Texas. And she said, no, come to Asheville. Asheville is perfect. That's where you can do your business, and you'll love Asheville. Perfect climate. Perfect everything.
Everything's perfect. All right. You had a perfect life ahead of you. As you well know, it's never a perfect life, as indicated by all the shows that we've done. Are there a couple that really, you know, I'm also amazed by the hard work. I could never do your jobs, both of your jobs, but people don't realize that you're what makes this show. I mean, it's absolutely true. And I'm wondering if there are times, we only have a minute left, KP, where you've... just been particularly proud of what came on the air.
There's two times that came into my mind. We did a show on co-op housing, and it was something that when I pitched to you, you were not sure, you knew enough information about it, and I was glad to give it to you. And I remember you doing the show and just being your eyes were wide open in learning this topic. And there were tons of calls, and lots of people knew about it. And so I knew that would be a good topic, and I'm glad I talked you into it. So I felt good about that show. The other one that I'm really proud of is, you know, obviously everyone knows Kathleen loves Abraham Lincoln, and we were doing a show, and it was kind of something that I had been working on without telling her, and I was able to get Ken Burns as a guest to talk about Abe Lincoln and the Gettysburg Address. Yeah. So that was another really good one that I was proud of.
Thank you. Thank you for everything. Thank you so much.
Thank
we
you.
Are really
going to
miss
you, pal.
You.
Thanks.
Yeah, we sure are. And thanks to KP Whaley, last time I'll say that, and Scotty Myers, I won't say that for the last time, for producing this show. And thanks to Katie Madsen Cyrus for production, and Lisa Nalbandian.